Say, it's a joy to be with you again. It reminds me of those times when I was a regular sub and times between your pastors, and I wouldn't wish my happiness to get in here more as against your delight in having two ministers of the gospel who are both friends of mine and faithful men. I want to say to Joe and Harry, no fear, I'm not going to preach tonight the same sermon I preached on our road trip yesterday. It wasn't a very good sermon because I did not have my Bible open, so it was a lot of thoughts from me. But our purpose was good, and I suppose a year ago you might have joined our presbytery, our synod, in asking God to raise up ministers of the gospel for a number of vacancies. And honestly, in the next 10 weeks or so, the Lord is bringing three brand new ministers from outside of our region, men that we did not have a strong hand in preparing, and it's like overflowing gifts from God. And may we be generous in the times when we get to share some of our best students. But I think we had a need. The Lord heard us. And so we trust that Laramie, Westminster, Denver, and Manhattan, Kansas will be supplied with young, strong preachers of the gospel very soon. Will you turn in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 17? Exodus chapter 17. I find this on page 75 in this Bible in the pew there. I'll go ahead and read this text tonight. It's not that long. And I think whoever edited this version did well. Two sections, water in the rock or water from the rock, and Amalek fought. And I think that well expresses the two main things in this chapter. But you'll hear reference to Massa and Meribah. And that's what we sang about tonight, and that's the call to worship as well, that don't be like this generation. So let's listen, Exodus chapter 17. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, and the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massa and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar and named it, "The Lord is my banner." And he said, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." We're in a series in Lawrence, so I'm going to try to summarize a lot of content briefly, but I know that you've had access to Exodus all your lives, so you might know a lot of this already. But if Exodus 16, the preceding chapter, could be known as God Sends Israel to School, which I think is a fair way to talk about this time in the wilderness, and wilderness being one of the better schools where we can learn deep things from God. If Exodus 16 is God sends Israel to school, Exodus 17 is like the course introduction. Before we get into a one-year series, not starting tonight, but I mean, I think Israel is going to be in this wilderness spot for about a year. It's very close to Sinai here, and I believe they camp at that point, and they learn a lot of lessons. Or you might say they're in school for 40 years, or they've been in school all throughout the Old Testament right into today. But Exodus 17 is like a course introduction with some major themes that God is going to develop in the coming years. And Rephidim, they're not quite to Sinai, but Rephidim's close. It's just their campsite for a week. And one thing I want you to notice about Rephidim is there's no water supply there. Let me say that again. This is their campsite for approximately 2.5 million people and their animals, and there's no natural water supply. There's a thing today called smart water. I think you can buy it. It's very expensive water. But this doesn't seem very smart about water, does it? To camp 2.5 million, the size of Chicago, perhaps, as a city, in a place that doesn't have natural water for a week. We would say it's not very smart, except we have to abide by the text, which says in verse 1, chapter 17, verse 1, their camping arrangements were according to the command of the Lord. This is what God wanted. It probably seemed like a really dumb decision to the majority of Israel, and that's why they're grumbling and complaining. What are you doing, Moses? And was God in charge here or not? But why do you think Moses camped there? If you know the text, chapters before, God is leading in the camping arrangements by virtue of this pillar of cloud and fire. And he would lift up and move and they would follow and then it would settle and they would stay there for a while. And God is the one who decided this is where they're going to camp. So I take you back to the previous comment. They're in the school of the wilderness, and the best place for them to learn deep lessons of trusting in God is in a place of natural lack. So God did this on purpose. And already they're failing in lesson number one. Instead of saying, I wonder what God's going to do here. Has God provided for this people across the preceding 2 months? And that, by the way, takes them back into their enslavement. Had they seen the actions of God, the power of God on display for them? Absolutely. But they're quick to forget. And so this grumbling, this clear direction of God in the camping arrangement magnifies the sins of verses 1 through 7. The sins of verses 1 through 7, which are, I think it's very clear that these are sins because God mentions it again in Psalms 81 and 95. He asks Israel for the rest of their history and us as the New Testament church to sing about this. And we sing about Massa and Meribah. Don't be like them. And your text, if you followed the Pew Bible, it gives us a definition or a translation of those words, Massa and Meribah. They mean testing and quarreling. I don't think these places had those names before this moment, but because this was a place of monumental Chicago-wide grumbling for a week, they got new names, terrible names, Massa and Meribah, testing and quarreling. But for each of those words, it goes both directions. Let me explain. They were testing God. The children of Israel were testing God. They were questioning his power, his wisdom, his patience, and his goodness. And let me ask you, how's God doing in this test? Does he come through? 100%. If there was possible 110%, 110%. We'll give it to him. God is perfectly passing every test. Can you even provide a table in the wilderness for people? Yes, he can. His power, his wisdom, his patience, his goodness. And yet I said it's a double test. God is, interestingly, testing them. God came through with flying colors. He gets to go to Harvard, 1600 on his SAT. Is it still SAT, 1600? Is that the perfect score? For a long time, that was the perfect score. Kids, you'll have to trust me on that. You're coming to a generation, you don't even have tests anymore. I'm sorry. I don't know what that's about. But God is acing this, and yet now God bounces it back to them. He's testing them, and let me suggest or ask, how are they doing? How are they doing? God is testing their faith in him. Their trust, and their joy. I think their joy is at an all-time low. Of course, every day it's kind of high and then low. This is a very fickle, immature people. Israel is failing in their test. But in the same way, the other word, quarrel, the places are called testing and quarrel. They have a quarrelsome spirit, and yet even God is in here as well. The word quarrel also has to do with controversy, and there's legal language here. God says, I have a legal case to press with you. And the prophets actually develop this into the coming centuries. Many of the prophets come forward to Israel as if God has a case against you. And what judge can possibly try this case between God and Israel except God himself? But this is based on a covenant, an agreement. Of course, it's an agreement that God takes all the leadership in, but he has come through with his side of the covenant over and over again. And here's this people already. They're in their first 2 months. God is providing miraculously for them in the wilderness. And he has a quarrel with them. I have kept my side of the agreement. You have not kept yours. A quarrel suggests the issue of justice. Justice is a big word in our culture today, social justice. And I don't want us to get lost in the negatives about that. We have a lot of concerns about the social justice movement. But justice is a very important thing to Americans, really to every human. And God has an issue of justice. There's got to be a judge who's called to rule which party is in the wrong. Simply saying God has every right at this point. And any fair judge would say, Israel, you have failed. It's very early in your covenant, but you have failed so badly that this covenant is broken. And God, you are the innocent party here. You have every right to go off and form new arrangements. You do not have to keep your word to these people at all because they have ignored it entirely. Does God take anybody up on that offer? He does not. He continues to keep his side of this covenant, and it turns out he's ultimately going to keep their side of the covenant as well. Israel has a problem, and I'm going to mention the two-side problem that they have, and I'm going to mention it clearly so that you might consider, do you have this problem? Do you have this problem? It's no good for me just to teach a Bible lesson here without application for you, okay? It's a double problem. They doubt God's wisdom, and they emphasize the glories of their recent past. That's what they're doing. In this section of Exodus, about 10 chapters, over and over again, they look at their situation under God as their master, and they are complaining, God, you're not doing a good enough job taking care of us. And then their minds curiously go back to a couple months ago, the good old days when Pharaoh was their loving master. If you didn't know what slavery was like, and if you didn't know the first three or four chapters, the first, say, eight chapters of Exodus, if you would only go by what they said about Pharaoh in the wilderness, you would think that that was a love story. They're heartsick. They want to get back to their loving master. You get it completely wrong. Say, God, you are a fool and you hate us. Pharaoh loved us. Meat pots, leeks and onions and garlic. Oh, at least we had water back there. Oh, why can't we get rid of this leader and get back to there? Is there a hint in this text that they want to kill Moses? Did you catch that? I would not think this is an exaggeration by Moses. Moses is talking to God and said, hey, they're ready to stone me to death. And they actually try to do that later. And this is a terrible place that they've come to. And they attribute all of this to the hatred of God. He wants to kill us. They're actually thinking in their minds that we have greater love than our God does. Think of every father, every human father in Israel. He's thinking, I would take better care of my children than God has taken care of them. Think of every cowboy who has animals that he's trying to care. I would do a better job taking care of my cows and sheep and goats than God is doing. This is bordering on blasphemy. Why do I say bordering? I'm just being nice. This is blasphemy. They've stepped across the line saying, I would be a better God for me than you are being for me. And you see how blasphemy is something that begins in the heart. They've voiced it. And pretty quickly, it's also turning toward a murderous attempt against Moses. These kinds of inner sins eventually bubble out until our hands are going to take action. I think God is the only one, because of this miracle water from a rock, he halts them in their murderous ways. The covenant, again, is broken. From Israel's side, but God's faithfulness is on display. This miraculous love to the undeserving, and then I want you to hear me say it stronger, the counter-deserving. These are not just an undeserving people. They are a counter-deserving people. Let me explain. What do they deserve? Do they deserve something? They are a deserving people. They deserve the wrath of God. If only just say he's going to go to the other side of the universe and not pay attention for a week. And what's going to happen at Rephidim, a place with no natural water? God would not have to strike them dead. He'd just go off and say, okay, and I'll come back and see what happens. He'd find corpses on the ground. That's what they deserve. They deserve the opposite of what God's going to give, miracle water from the rock. God works this wonder through Moses. Why do you think God works this wonder through Moses? You know that God could snap his finger or just speak a word from his mouth and water flows from rocks, but why does he work through Moses in a very public way, striking a large rock with a strong stick, which certainly makes a sound, and all at least the elders are watching this. God is building up Moses in their sight. God is saying, I'm going to work through this man. This is your mediator. I'm working with him. Trust him. He's building him up. So lesson number one, if you want to take any notes here, there's just five little lessons. And here, 15 minutes into the sermon, we're at lesson number one. You mathematicians, let's see, what is that? Oh my, maybe no psalm sing. Lesson number one, simple. Don't be like this people. Don't be like this people. The Psalms say the same thing. Hebrews says the same thing. Anything that God says twice is magnified. He says it four times in the Bible. Don't be like this people. God is merciful to this people. He extends his patience with this people. But God doesn't like this. That's very clear. And then we get into verses 8 through 13, the military victory over Amalek. And before we get into that in the specifics, I want you to see that both miracles here, the water from the rock, and the victory over the army, and I call it a miracle, and you'll see in a moment, both of them involved means. God involves means. Again, he could snap his finger or use his voice, but in the issue of thirst, he used Moses. He used a staff or that stick or the rod. He used the rock. He used the action of striking, and here comes the water to satisfy their thirst. Okay? The second thing, the victory over Amalek, God again used Moses. He used the staff and the stick again. He used the issue of prayer. He used these two men, Aaron and Hur. He used Joshua and an army. So God is a God who can do things very quickly, but sometimes he uses means, and I think that's very encouraging to us because I believe that God has used, is using, and will continue to use Shawnee Reformed Presbyterian Church for the revival that God is going to bring to greater Kansas City. And won't it be exciting when God does that you will know he could have done it without us. But he, for our joy and his glory, he chose to use us in that, in all of our weaknesses, because we're a little bit too much like Israel. But God is going to use a people like this. I want you to understand that though we don't find the language of shepherding here, what God does in the wilderness for Israel, he's a very good shepherd. They doubt his abilities. They are testing him and quarreling against him. But God is actually being an outstanding shepherd for Israel. You know, we talked before, I think it was a couple years ago, preached a sermon on what a good shepherd does for his sheep. And literal shepherds actually do water their sheep very well. Psalm 23 emphasizes that. He takes them past good places of water. Thirsty sheep don't do very well. Also, sheep in a panic, sheep that are surrounded by enemies, their hearts get racing, they can't rest, they can't digest their food, and they die also from that. And so God is satisfying two primary needs of his flock here. Even while they're grumbling against him, he is caring for them by giving them water from a miraculous rock. And then the second thing, taking care of these enemies. And we don't want to get into that now. The Amalekites are a well-trained desert tribe. It's their territory. They know the hills. They know the hiding places. They have the weapons. And describe Israel's army. This is not a conversation, but think about Israel's army. We wouldn't call them that, would we? They're refugees. They've just gotten out of 400 years of bondage. I doubt they even have any weapons. I wonder if Joshua, a thought for a moment. Moses says, Joshua, I'll tell you what. You go pick some men and you go fight in that valley and I'm going to go up on the hill. And if this was full of jokes, we're not supposed to be full of jokes here, but if I was Joshua, I'd say, hey, I'll tell you what, why don't I go up on the hill, Moses, and you go down in the valley and pick some men. I think that's a better arrangement. Take away the jokes. What does Joshua say in this text? Actually, what does he do? Verse 10, Joshua did as Moses told him. Let me say that again, because I was hoping some people would fall off their pews onto the floor, because this is a powerful moment. Joshua did as Moses told him. This is the most refreshing thing I've heard for about seven chapters, because all the other Israelites pretty much all the time are, oh, do we have to do that? Where are you, God? And here's the first Israelite to actually do what he's told. Imagine that. Imagine how life would be for this nation if the majority or all of them did as God told them. Not even a, you know, I kind of saw the humor in there, but I don't think it's very funny. Joshua doesn't grumble and say, Moses, I'm not sure. He does what Moses tells him. And the Lord works it out. You know about the Amalekites? They're connected to Esau. Now, Esau, way back in Genesis, Jacob and Esau, a few things we know about Esau. The Bible emphasizes this one primary thing. His God was his belly or his lusts. He wanted what he wants, and that got him into all sorts of trouble with his parents, with his brother, with his God. But as far as we know, Esau never repented. He went whistling through life, and then he died. And it says in the text of the Bible, God hated Esau. I do not think we're going to have a conversation with Esau in heaven. Tell us about your lustful, belly-filled life. I think he enjoyed the things of this earth, and then he died. And he went to the place where sinners go. And don't be like the Israelites. And I think God, instantly after this grumbling session, he points out the Amalekites, who are, we don't know much about them, except they're descended from Esau. Here's the generational result. Here's 5 to 10 generations after Esau, and here's a people that God is actually, at the end of the text, he has promised, I'm going to snuff them out. I do not like this people, and really we'd get behind that. I don't like this attitude. I don't like this spirit that I belong to me, and my belly wants what it wants. It wants porridge now. It wants two wives here. It wants what it wants, and I'm going to get it. And Israel's becoming that. Apart from God's intervening mercy, they would become just like this. And God would have to snuff them out. Lessons, if you're taking, don't be like Esau. Don't be like the Israelites at Massa and Meribah, testing and quarreling with God. Don't be like Esau. Don't be like the Amalekites, who must be very much like their forefather. Be like Joshua, if you're taking quick notes. Be like Joshua. Now, we're going to learn a whole lot more about Joshua. Did you know? Joshua's name appears in the Bible 222 times. I'm so grateful for Bible search tools because I didn't have to actually count that yesterday. I should have done that in the vehicle and you'd be better off, Joe and Harry. But I didn't. I just did a quick search. 222 times. This is the first reference to Joshua. The very first time we see this man's name. And what do we learn about him? He did as Moses told him. Let me suggest to you, Joshua at this point is 40 years old. And he gets the top chair. He's like the vice president. And he is exalted to the presidency at 80 years of age. That's a long time to be in chair number two. And even at 80, God is having to encourage Joshua. Be strong and courageous. You can do this. We can do this. This is a man who's willing to submit to the leadership that God has given. All right? Let me get behind the text just a little bit. Do you know, Joshua's mommy and daddy never referred to him as Joshua. They called him Yeshua. We're not a Hebrew-speaking congregation, but I'm going to guess that most of you have heard that word before, Yeshua. You've heard that sound before. We don't usually associate Yeshua with this guy. We associate Yeshua with another guy. And in the Greek way of saying it, we call it Jesus, and in English, we call that one Jesus. The first time we meet this Joshua, he is willing and ready and eager to do what his commanding officer tells him to do. And doesn't that remind you of somebody? I've laid out every hint I can. I'd almost have to just give it to you. You know, I'll give you a 1600 on the SAT. Here it is. Okay, this is about Jesus. Be like Joshua, but ultimately... Be like Joshua as he follows Christ and that spirit of compliance with the good order. And of course, Jesus does everything. He even said that, I think, at the Last Supper in that long speech in the Gospel of John. I have done everything, Father, that you have given me to do. I have fulfilled every purpose I came for. I live to do. I do nothing except the thing that you told me to do. This is the perfect spirit of Joshua, where I'm confident that this merely human Joshua fell short. We know that he falls short in his earthly life. But this spirit is something that I would say to you, be like Joshua. Don't be like Israel at Massah and Meribah, at quarreling and testing. Don't be like the Amalekites descended from Esau. Their God is their belly, and so they need to be exterminated. Be like Joshua, ultimately be like Jesus, and doing as the leader tells him to do. Verse 9, do you notice a strange way of referring to something, the staff? How does verse 9 refer to the staff? It's called what? The staff of God. Isn't that interesting? I thought it was the staff of Moses. This object, which is a stick, will actually be passed down to Joshua, but it's the staff of God. First of all, because everything belongs to God, but I think we're being taught here that the power is not Moses. It's not Moses who brought forward the water. It's not Moses who gave you bread in the wilderness. It's not Moses who gave you victory. It's not Joshua. It's God. The staff is of God. These men are from God. These blessings are from the Lord. God is the power. That's another lesson to write in. God is the power behind this story, the entire story of the Exodus and the wilderness and the story of our lives. I praised God, and I mentioned before that you have two faithful ministers of the gospel. And then I mentioned three brand new ones coming into the west of us. Isn't that great? But ultimately, one of our preachers at the ordination installation service, he said to young Joe Smith, he said, Joe, I don't mean to hurt your feelings. He says, nobody wants to hear your ideas, Joe. Nobody really wants to hear what you think. Are we going to have a fight here? No, it was a good word. Joe, preach the word. Preach Christ. Preach the clear word of God. That's what you're assigned to do. And that's what you want from your pastors. Talented, gifted men, but ultimately the staff of God, the pastors of God, the work of God, the church of God. God is the power. The emphasis of this passage is that the work that Israel did, especially the leaders, was to pray to God. Did you recognize this is the first battle victory of Israel in the wilderness, and Joshua will lead them into other victories in Canaan 40 years later? But this first one is a template and a model. Who's winning these wars for Israel? And let me emphasize, do you have some battles to fight here in Greater Kansas City? I don't mean with and against each other. I mean against the world, the flesh, and the devil that surrounds you. You are outnumbered, by the way, on a human level. But on another level, you can't lose. It is the Lord who's winning this victory. And the symbol of that is the victory goes well when they're crying out to God. When they're calling out to God, they're winning. And symbolically, when they're not calling out to God, to the symbol of the hands, they're losing. Let us take that very clearly. The prayer is the work. Prayer is the battle. God's work is to win this battle. Our work is to cry out in faith to God, asking God to win the battle, and then offering ourselves freely, say, okay, what part should I play? We're not lazy. That is, we don't just sit in the prayer closet and pray 24/7. I understand there's an international house of prayer around here. I don't know what you think about that, but I admire their commitment to pray, but I would like to think anybody in my church who thinks 24/7, that's all they're going to do is pray, say it sometimes, actually to Joshua. Later text says, get up off your knees, Joshua. It's not time to pray. It's time to go out and do some work. So let's do that, and let's do the work prayerfully. We must depend on the Lord. Some pray a lot, some fight a lot, but all of us trust and depend on God. We're almost done. At the end, I should have just said this, take notes. And that's the last point. God says to Moses, take notes on this. Write this down. And I wonder if this is the beginning of the Bible. What do I mean by that? When is Genesis written? When physically is the book of Genesis written down? It's clearly when Moses is in the wilderness with his people. He's got 40 years. You can write a lot. But God's here says, write this down. What's this? How you won the battle today. Write it down so Joshua never forgets, and write it down so the others never forget. And we are a people who forget. They've already forgotten many times in these 2 months, the mercies of God in Egypt 2 months before. And then manna every day. They're forgetting the mercies of God. It says, write this down. Write this history, especially for Joshua the leader. Remember how we won the battle, or how the Lord won the battle. In verse 15, we see one of the very precious names of God, Yahweh Nissi, in the Hebrew, Yahweh Nissi. A couple chapters ago, it was Yahweh Rapha, the Lord our healer, Yahweh, the Lord our provider, Jehovah Jireh, Yahweh Yireh. This one is Yahweh Nissi, the Lord our banner. And that's kind of an odd thing for us, but what does an army need? In the days before walkie-talkies and before satellite technology, what do we need to coordinate the army? We need a banner, somebody who's lifting this up next to the general and says, rally here. Now, rally over here. And there's great stories, even into the Civil War of the United States, where the presence of a banner or the absence of a banner made all the difference. Our covenanter history, by the way, you might know this. It's right up there. I'm sorry, you can't see it. I can see it. It's backward. I guess it's for the world to see. For Christ's crown and covenant. There it is. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, I think I have a slight suggestion for you all. Let's put a couple bullet holes through that. Okay? And maybe a little blood and some tatter. And no disrespect to the beautiful, you know, velvet of a, but it's a battle banner in our history, isn't it? This was not hung up in a church first. It was for the army. People, literal warfare out there fighting for God, fighting for the church's rights. And now it's a beautiful thing. And that's fine. But if you want to, somebody take it out and shoot it full of holes or something. And then it says that message. And the Lord is our banner. If the Lord is our banner, are there any holes in him? Yeah. Even in his resurrected life, he's proving to Thomas and others that this is me, and you can tell because of the winnings, how he won our salvation through his suffering. The Lord is our banner, our visible rallying point, the identification. I fight under that banner. I identify with that army, the identification for God's army, God's company, and our victory. Reference to an altar in verse 15. Of course, there has to be an altar in every one of these stories if it's not specified. We're thanking God through this sacrifice, thanksgiving, but on an altar, you burn an animal. The fact that God can work with this cantankerous, grumbling, questioning, testing people, this quarrelsome people, is because of a sacrifice that God is going to make fully someday. Let me conclude with a little bit from Christian art. In the early Christian church, the era when the Roman Empire was seeking to stamp them out, a lot of Christians, especially around the larger cities like Rome, they couldn't even bury their loved ones in a public manner. They couldn't live in a public manner, so they often lived in the catacombs. You can still visit these places. These are salt mines that they turned into grave sites, and Christians hid down there, and they buried their dead down there, and it's fascinating. You can even see some Christian art, early Christian art, on the walls of the catacombs. And two primary images for Jesus. Now, I know that we're in a church that doesn't appreciate image of Jesus, but I think this first one's pretty awesome. When they wanted to refer to Jesus, they showed an ark, Noah's ark. Did you know that? Noah's ark on a gravestone was their way of talking about Jesus. What does Noah's ark have to do with Jesus? Well, that first huge time that God sent worldwide judgment, Who survived? Who survived the worldwide judgment? Only those who were encased in the ark and lifted up. They didn't miss the rain. They didn't miss the waves, but they survived the judgment. Those who were in the ark survived the judgment. And they're saying to each other, there's a wave coming against us. It's called Caesar and the Roman Empire. And this is really tough. But you know what? Those of us who are in Christ are going to survive this. Did they? Where are the emperors of Rome today? They're dead. Where are Christians today? Hey, we're right here. That's pretty awesome. And another image, it's a little bit more questionable, but Jesus would often be depicted in a simple form, and sometimes he'd have a lamb around his neck, which is pretty cool, Jesus the shepherd. But another time would be Jesus with his hands lifted up. And the nickname for these art forms are called Christus Victor. I think you can figure this out. Christus Victor, what does it mean? Jesus the winner. Jesus the winner. Did I read a text tonight, Exodus 19? Was there somebody who looked like this in his posture? Who was it? Moses. Of course, to be honest, you'd have to add in a rock to support him because he's weak, and you'd have to have another man here, another here. But in the depictions of Jesus with his arms upraised, either blessing the people in benediction or lifting up in prayer, which is kind of a symbol of what Jesus is doing today. Jesus is praying for his people. He's blessing his people. But who's supporting the arms of Jesus in these depictions? Any guesses? You're right, nobody. It's a good answer. You didn't answer, so it's a no answer. There's nobody supporting the arms of Jesus. Why is that? He needs no help. He needs no Aaron. He needs no her. He asked in the Garden of Gethsemane, could you not stay and pray with me? Could you not? But he wants us to pray. He enjoys our prayers. But ultimately, Jesus has his hands upraised. He's blessing the church. And let me just say it clearly. As long as Jesus' hands are lifted up, who's going to win? I think you know the answer to that question. So sadly, at 2 o'clock this morning, Jesus is getting tired. So from 2 to 3 a.m., he needs a little bit of He never slumbers. He never sleeps. He's ever mediating for us in the perfect tabernacle. He's ever calling out to his Father. And everything Jesus asked for of his Father, he gets. And he's asking for our blessing. That blessing includes some trials. It includes camping at Rephidim sometimes where we might be inclined to say, what are you doing? I've done that before. Sorry, that's not good. Don't be like them. I shouldn't be like that. But you can be like them. You can be trusting in Jesus whose hands are lifted up. Jesus, the perfect Yeshua. Jesus, our Lord. Amen.